Joining me now to decide what kind of glass we're looking at, Farah Chidea, a veteran journalist and fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's University Kennedy School of Government, and Matt Welch, editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Thank you both for being here.
Yes, just delighted to see you.
Thank you. So, okay, we have made the move now to presidential politics. I mean, the fact is Rick Santorum is really unlikely to win this primary. It looks like it's going to be Mitt Romney. The president is now name-checking Mitt Romney. We are in the fast lane, and this is going to be about jobs. Is our glass half full or half empty?
I think the report that came yesterday is a half-empty report in itself. 120,000 is not a good number. It's a bad number. A lot of people are kind of reeling from it. The number that probably we should be focusing on the most is workforce participation. How many people who are of able body and age and mind are actually working? That number is below where it was 1 year ago during this time of recovery where we think we've been, you know, inching in a better direction. It was 64.2% in March of last year. It's 63.8% now. Now, those numbers are as bad as they've been since the Carter-Reagan recession of 78 to 82, 83. That is the real problem, and what the president and his supporters have to kind of overcome, or what they have to sell, is that it could be a lot worse. And that's kind of what they've been hitting now for a couple of years. That might be enough to rally their base, but it'll be difficult to maintain that support among independents that he seems to be having right now over Romney.
Well, so now that's interesting, because this question of whether or not it's bad or good might actually be ancillary to whether or not it's bad or good for election or for political purposes, right? So if we have lower labor force participation, if 120,000 new jobs does not actually mean a strong economy, but if you have, I was just looking at these numbers on economic confidence in March, which is at its highest since January of 2008. So we're looking now just before the 2008 election cycle really kicked off. And now we've got high economic confidence. If, in fact, people perceive this, if it's framed as good, even if it might not be good empirically, is that still enough for the president?
Well, politically, I think that, you know, the president is on track with the economy. It may not be where we want it to be overall, but I do think for political purposes, the president seems like someone who, you know, and he did lift us up from the absolute nadir of our economy in recent decades and bring us back to a functional level. I do think that this report has some half full, half empty elements. I completely agree about the overall question of job force, labor force participation, but I also think there's, you know, another of the figures I've been looking at is what's called economic hysteresis, which is basically that people who are unemployed become unemployable. Oh, and what you see is that compared to any other point in American history, the length of unemployment is about twice as long. Yeah. So people are out of the labor force for, you know, sometimes 40 weeks and sometimes longer. And that's something that I think that the president's policies have not so far addressed.
Right, we talked about this a little bit on the show, this idea that there are actually job listings, right, listings for employment opportunities, that because being long-term unemployed is not a protected class, they'll actually say you must currently have a job in order to even apply for this job. And that might in part go to your earlier point. Let me ask this, Farah, because I know that some of your work has been on this, and I'd also be interested particularly kind of in a libertarian perspective around this. If the president is in part going to run on where unemployment is and the health of the economy, and you have a Republican Party that is saying government cannot create jobs, only the private sector can create jobs, is this fully a conversation, therefore, for Republicans about tax policy? Or is there something that this president is meant to be doing despite the fact that government doesn't create jobs? Like, this is, for me, like a serious both political and empirical challenge. How do you make that claim?
Well, let me, you know, totally agree with you here. It's what's fascinating to me is that the president has continued to frame, you know, the jobs outlook, understandably, as the growth in private sector jobs. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that the African-American unemployment rate is so high is because, you know, in a time, say the 1950s, 1960s, right, when it was hard for black people to break into private sector employment because of discrimination, a lot of folks, including people in my family, went into government. Yeah. You know, your bus drivers, your civil servants, your teachers.
School teachers and postal workers.
Exactly. I have both in my family. Yeah. But what we've seen is a continuing decline in public sector employment. And the president doesn't seem willing to make the case that we will increase it, and the Republicans definitely aren't going to go there. So I do think that when we look at the, you know, I personally think that that smart judgments about strong public sector jobs. Who would argue that kids in America don't need more, that seniors don't need more? There are a lot of things that we could do that could be public sector employment, but it's a political untouchable right now.
Yeah, Matt, weigh in on this for me.
Well, yeah, I think what's interesting about the way that Obama went after Romney today, or this week, is that he didn't really go after Romney as much as he went after Paul Ryan. He wanted to make Mitt Romney be Paul Ryan, and they haven't been traditionally. Paul Ryan is a wonk. People who disagree with him respect where he's coming from. He actually has an articulated vision that if you shrink the size of government, you increase the opportunity elsewhere, and that you have to tackle the entitlements time bomb and go after things like housing policy. Mitt Romney has not been running on that campaign. Mitt Romney has been running criticizing Obama for cutting Medicare, criticizing Rick Perry for calling Social Security a Ponzi scheme, saying that Newt Gingrich doesn't want to increase military spending enough. He has not been running a government-cutting strategy.
Which is why the critique from the right has been so powerful on Romney.
And so Obama is almost trying to bait a conversation that would actually be a real conflict of visions, and that would be more interesting, I think, than what we have currently. I mean, Romney is kind of the classic Chamber of Commerce Republican, where you attack Obama for being anti-business because he's not handing out enough goodies to business. This doesn't have a lot to do with actual free market philosophy.
I love it. How to make the 2012 election actually more interesting to cover.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about women and women's issues lately, as there should be. But I do think that the conversation's been oversimplified. Women are not some monolithic block. Women are not an interest group. You shouldn't be treated that way.
That was the president stating the obvious, or what should be obvious, at yesterday's White House forum on women in the economy. But unfortunately, we've reached a political moment where it actually needed to be said. As both Democrats and Republicans jockey for position to prove who most feels women's pain, the idea that women are, you know, human beings and not a collection of walking, talking uteri has suddenly become a novel concept. Still with me to help sort out who's getting it right and who just doesn't get it. Farai Chidea and Matt Welch. Joining us at the table is Liza Mundy. She's the author of The Richer Sex and a fellow at the New America Foundation. Also with us from Washington, D.C., Julianne Malvo, president of Bennett College. Very nice to have all of you here. Okay, we need to talk about caterpillars first. Now, I will say we have an actual caterpillar on set. There are a lot of young children in the Nerdland family. We actually even have the very hungry caterpillar in Hebrew for Passover as well as in English. And I just want to take a moment and listen to the caterpillar comment, which was Reince Priebus on Bloomberg's TV's Political Capital with Al Hunt. He said this.
If the Democrats said we had a war on caterpillars, and every mainstream media outlet talked about the fact that Republicans have a war on caterpillars, then we'd have problems with caterpillars. I mean, the fact of the matter is it's a fiction.
Dr. Malvo, can I go to you first? Okay, so we have the Republicans on one hand saying that we've got, if this were war on caterpillars, we'd have a problem with caterpillars. But of course, it's not caterpillars. It is actual women who the White House had yesterday to talk about economic questions. So when we think about that intersection between gender and the economy, what are there specific women's issues, or are women economic voters in precisely the same ways that men are?
No, there are specific women's issues, and I must say I was at the conference yesterday. It was very exhilarating. There were three cabinet members there, and there's a report out, Melissa, that talks about what this administration has done. First of all, the fact that there's so many single mothers makes it very important that we talk about issues therein. Women who are married or men who are married have unemployment rates of about 4.2 to 5.3%. Single moms have an unemployment rate of 12.6%. So targeting to those moms, but also providing some of the services to those moms, only 3% of Fortune 500 companies have childcare. So we look at those are gender specific things. Women also, Melissa, are more likely than men to receive the Pell Grant. 60% of Pell Grant recipients are women. Social Security, again, because women live longer than men do. Those are women-specific policies. Now, one might say when you improve Social Security, you improve it for men as well. But basically, women tend to be a bit more dependent on an economy that is driven by services. And so I know that Liza Mundy's book about the richer sex focuses on the top, but when we look at many things, we need to focus on the bottom, and we find not the glass ceiling for many women, but the sticky floor.
Right. We literally are the very hungry caterpillar in the economy, Liza.
Yes, and I would say, I mean, I don't think that I focus just on the top. In my book, I interviewed a lot of women who were supporting their families during the recession. Their husbands had lost jobs. I spent a lot of time in Michigan talking to women who had been stay-at-home moms, women who had had part-time jobs, who had taken full-time jobs, second jobs to support their families. And I checked in with them recently, and even if their husbands have gone back to work, they're all still in the labor force. They're all still working. And the president alluded in his talk yesterday to the growing number of women who are breadwinners in their households, single moms, and also women who went to work during the recession or had been working all along, and the fact that they face a gender wage gap, so that often women are supporting households on less than a man might make.
And Matt, you made the point earlier that the president is in part trying to frame Mitt Romney in the context of Paul Ryan. So I wanted to listen, because the president used really strong language in talking about that Ryan plan, and I think it actually connects in certain ways to this question around gender. So let's listen to what the president had to say here.
Disguised as deficit reduction plans, it is really an attempt to impose a radical vision on our country. It is thinly veiled social Darwinism.
So he's calling it thinly veiled social Darwinism, this idea that we'll just let those who are most vulnerable kind of fall away. We will not feed the very hungry caterpillars who are women voters worried about the economy. Is that a fair critique?
No. Three things about that. One, the social Darwinism charge is a 50-year-old slur by the historian Richard Hofstadter against the Victorian era critical philosopher Herbert Spencer, who didn't actually support social Darwinism. He said, I think that we shouldn't have social Darwinism as our social policy. So to repeat that is a little inaccurate. Paul Ryan's budget increases the size of the federal budget from $3.6 trillion to $4.9 trillion in 10 years and goes nowhere near to balancing the budget. If that is social Darwinism, then we're completely out and we're screwed, because we won't be able to afford our own government. So no, I don't think that applies. In terms of gender politics, a couple of things. One is, I think that this peaked in February and March when we were having that awful transvaginal moment,
when the transvaginal moment was awful. Yes,
it's still going on for many women across America. Yeah. Unfortunately,
on the state and local level, much more for sure. Mitt Romney's not going to run on that. He was pro-choice before he was not pro-choice, and all that. He's not going to be making that case. He made that case very insincerely, to the extent to which he tried to win the nomination, and he's pretty much got that wrapped up. He's not going to be running on that in the general election. For people who are strongly pro-choice, they will have enough to be alarmed by Mitt Romney and the Republican Party, to be sure, but we're not going to be talking about transvaginal issues in the way that
it's very interesting, because we've seen it, just as that transvaginal moment was occurring, right, at least in terms of, not just in terms of policy, right, but the rhetoric around it, we saw independent women move dramatically towards the president in these polls. So we have Mitt Romney at 37%, President Obama at 51% among swing state independent women, precisely the women, the voters who could choose whom the next president will be. But if that's being driven primarily by reproductive choice rhetoric rather than by what is going to happen in the general election, then that might change.
Well, it might change, but I do think that, if you look at the battles over reproductive rights, they've played out over several decades already. And people are not going to forget by November that, who has basically championed an agenda in terms of interest groups and parties, certainly not the Democrats and not the progressives, that literally inserts probes into women's bodies. And I do want to point out, I've gotten to know, while I'm up at Harvard at the Institute of Politics, people who work in regions, who are former elected officials from places like Oklahoma, which, does have a very frightening law on the books right now. It's being held up by sort of a judicial review, but this is not over. This is not over. It won't be over.
And particularly because, in part, the transvaginal moment has led us to being more willing to accept general ultrasound laws and other kinds of encroachments that somehow feel less literally probing.
I just remind conservative commentators that for years what we've heard is the biggest problem on the bench was judicial activism or a lack of judicial restraint. That an unelected group of people would somehow overturn a duly constituted and passed law. Well, there's a good example, and I'm pretty confident that this court will recognize that and not take that step.
That was the statement President Obama made on Monday that started a week of back and forth about whether the president was attempting to influence or even intimidate the highest court in the land as it considers the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Now, the political backlash to the president's remark was immediate. Senator Mitch McConnell called it beyond distasteful, while Justice Anthony Scalia dismissed his words, saying the Supreme Court doesn't respond to criticism. Ah, yes, the pesky separation of powers issue. Only Congress can initiate legislation. The president has to sign off to turn those acts into law. Remember, you know, I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill. Remember the little ditty? But in the end, it is those nine unelected lifers who get to decide if the law stands. And all this checking and balancing is not just a scholarly exercise. It is inherently political. So here with me to parse the politics from the law is Kenji Yoshino, constitutional law professor at New York University, Jelani Cobb, professor of Africana Studies and History at Rutgers University, Matt Welch, editor-in-chief at Reason Magazine, and longtime journalist and friend and colleague Farai Chidea. It's lovely to have you all here. I wanted to just point out before we go on, because I really do want to ask about this, that this president is not the only president who at times has picked a fight with the Supreme Court. In fact, we have President Bush talking about activist judges while on the campaign trail. If we have that, I want to take a quick listen.
Do you think activist judges should be allowed to redefine our country and issue new laws from the bench? Vote Democrat. But if you believe that the role of the judge is to strictly interpret the Constitution and leave the legislating to the legislators, vote Republican.
Unfortunately, some judges give in to the temptation and make law instead of interpreting it.
I will continue to nominate men and women who understand that judges must be servants of the law and not legislate from the bench.
Right into the camera, not legislate from the bench. So, when I have anxiety, they paid you, Kenji. They're like, Melissa is freaking out about the Supreme Court. Please get us.
Take that.
Please get Kenji Yoshino in here. So talk to me about this. Is the president picking a fight in this moment, or is this just sort of how presidents behave relative to the court when their pet legislation is in front of the court?
Yeah, so I don't think the president is picking a fight. I think that he said one sentence that was extremely controversial, and he misspoke, and he probably would have worded his statement differently if he had the chance, where he said, because this is enacted by a democratically, you know, large majority of the Congress, then the court has to stand down. And that's clearly not true.
Right.
But anyone who is even law adjacent would understand that this was a misstep on his part. And in fact, if you look at the statement as a whole, before that, what he's talking about is the specific weeds of the Affordable Care Act and the specific precedents that, you know, have led up to basic statement that this is constitutional. So, to listen to the right talk about this, particularly the judges on the Fifth Circuit, who gave a homework assignment to the DOJ to write about this, you would think that the president was actually calling for the overruling of Marbury versus Madison, the 1803 case that says it's emphatically the province and the duty of the judiciary to say what the law is. This is really preposterous, and I think that we should give it the back of our hands.
Yeah, just in case you weren't watching up in the hours before, right, I just want to mention to viewers that a judge on the Fifth Circuit actually asked the Department of Justice to write kind of a student paper, right? It was like a three-page paper about Marbury versus Madison and judicial review, right, in order to demonstrate that the administration does still support a separation of powers in which the Supreme Court has the ability to do judicial review. Fry, I felt like you were wanting to jump in here.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with you on most points, Kenji, but I don't know if the president misspoke as much as spoke politically rather than legally. You know, obviously, he himself has a law degree and he himself is quite savvy, but I think that one of the sort of triangulations that's happening in the Obama campaign right now is the question of whether or not, you know, the disgruntled progressives who wanted President Obama to be more liberal are really, you know, going to follow him into the second election battle. And I wonder if he spoke the way that he did in order to sort of corral some people and say, I'm your, Obama won, you're our only hope, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
I think that's self-evidently true. I do think it is a political thing. Remember, this is the president who, during a State of the Union address, singled out the Supreme Court justices in attendance over Citizens United, which is a decision that he didn't like either. I think this will be a political issue. It's a huge, huge thing, right? This is a gigantic bill. This is one-sixth of the economy. If it is overturned or parts of it are overturned, it's going to dominate the political discussion. So, yes, of course he's going to use this to rally a disgruntled Democratic base going forward. And it is disappointing, I think, from the perspective, disappointing but not surprising, from the perspective of someone who's sort of billed as a constitutional thinker and these types of things to have this kind of formulation. Every president, of course, complains about the Supreme Court because they get their laws messed with, and he just turns out to be another president.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting in that way. I mean, on the one hand, he is this constitutional law scholar, but once he is in the role of president, the interests and the competing realities of being president, and your point about presidents don't like the Supreme Court, I was thinking about a conversation we'd had here on the show a couple of weeks ago about FDR,
right.
who so didn't like it that he figured he'd just change it by packing it.
Right. Well, I'm not so sure he was speaking politically. I think there was a political implication to what he said, but I think that the president was kind of meandering and he was uncharacteristically inarticulate here. Mm-hmm. But what he was referring to was quite simply judicial activism on the right. And he's really, I think we can make the argument that he's responding to a court that's functioning in a very politicized way. Mm-hmm. And so when we were talking a couple weeks ago, I said that Supreme Court justices don't always respond to the way the presidents want them to, even the presidents who appoint them. I think that I should have also added that, you know, since Bush v. Gore, we've seen a disturbing amount of parity between what political wing of a political party wants and what the Supreme Court justices are doing. Particularly when we saw how Justice Scalia talked about the 2,700 pages in the bill and can we actually go through all of it? Is it realistic or should we just scrap it and so on? That did not lend itself to thinking that this is an even-tempered judicial thinker here.
Let's distinguish among statements, because I think we're talking about two different statements here. I mean, one statement, you know, is I think the one that Jelani's referencing and that I was alluding to earlier is actually not the clip that you showed, but the statement where he says, because this was enacted by a strong majority of Congress, the Supreme Court should stand down. That is manifestly untrue, right? Mm-hmm. So even if, first of all, it wasn't a strong majority of Congress. Second of all, even if Congress unanimously said, oh, all states now get a third senator, there's no way the Supreme Court wouldn't strike that down. And everybody should and would agree that that was the province of the judiciary to strike that down. So I want to separate that statement out, which I think was a misstep on the president's part, from the broader context in which this was set, where he was clearly talking about the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Yep. Number one, and number two, talking about the charge that the right has always leveled at the left of judicial activism when the right is equally guilty of this. And I think because of the Warren Court years where there was judicial activism on the left, the right has made hay for a number of decades now out of the fact that liberal judges are activists. But conservative justices are just as activists, and we're seeing that now with cases like Citizens United, and so therefore it's now the left's turn to make hay out of the same point.
Right, if activism becomes the dirty word, right, in and of itself, then you want to be able to make this claim that is operating on this side as well. So are we in a position at this point where in fact the courts are not this sort of constitutionally imagined, separate from the people, separate from the politics, so that they can make these kinds of discretionary decisions without having to worry about re-election, right? That's sort of the point of an unelected Supreme Court. Or are they now actually too responsive to the politics that we're currently seeing?
I think that the Supreme Court is always responsive to public opinion. Probably probably more so than politics or parties in any given point. They don't want to get too far ahead of or behind public opinion. They're usually a lagging indicator. They'll come around 10, 15 years and ratify that we've changed our minds on certain things, as is happening, I think, with gay marriage, basically. Yeah. They will come around to where the culture is coming, you know, if it comes in front of them.
They'll come with all deliberate speed, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the most controversial Supreme Court decisions, like Roe v. Wade, that could be argued, regardless of the legal case of that, that they were a little bit out in front of the culture at that point, and it blew up on them, not immediately, interestingly enough, but a couple of years later. And so they are sensitive to that, and I think that makes the Affordable Care Act vulnerable on the individual mandate specifically, because that has never been popular, and majorities both don't like it and see it as unconstitutional. And I think that, plus the legal arguments, will give them some political cover, and they'll be more responsive to that, I think, than the Republican-Democratic squad.
I'm glad you brought us to Roe v. Wade, because coming up, the Supreme Court did something this week that's got me completely freaked out about Roe v. Wade, and so I want to ask all of you about it. That's going to be right after the break. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court ruled to allow for strip searches of people in jail, even for minor offenses. Now, that decision immediately made me wonder about the security of Roe v. Wade. Why? You probably think they're unrelated, but it felt to me like Monday's decision further stripped individual citizens of their rights to privacy in favor of the interests of the state. And as I've said before, the right to privacy is truly a fundamental tenet of citizenship. In fact, I think women didn't fully become citizens until that landmark case in 1973, Roe v. Wade, which was based, again, in part on privacy. So when the high court rules now that security trumps privacy, what is it saying? How will this potentially impact the meaning of privacy overall? Back with me to answer that question is Kenji Yoshino, Jelani Cobb, Matt Welch, and Farai Chidea. So talk me down from this. A couple of weeks ago, I was concerned that overturning the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate could possibly mean the 1964 Civil Rights Act because of Commerce Clause. Is this, now I know it's a Fourth Amendment, you know, instead of 14th, but if the government has a right, in this case, local government frontline police officers, to strip search my physical body, does that make my physical body less mine, less me able to keep it private in ways that could impact reproductive choice options later?
Yeah, so I hope I was able to talk you down about the Civil Rights Act a couple weeks ago, and I hope I'll be able to persuade you that you shouldn't be worried in this context, because privacy is really a term of art in the law, and it occurs in many different contexts. So privacy in the context of Fourth Amendment searches and seizures, like the criminal procedure amendments, is very different from privacy under the 14th Amendment, as you just alluded to. There is one very oblique connection, which is that both the Roe versus Wade line of privacy cases and the Fourth Amendment privacy cases are implicated in the original 1965 Griswold versus Connecticut contraception case. And in that case, the court said, we're going to discern the right to privacy in the shadows cast by these other amendments, like the First, Third, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments. And so if you go all the way back to 1965, you can see the two being knit together. So arguably, if you knock out one domino, it could actually have downstream implications for the 14th Amendment, but I think that's a pretty attenuated link. There are enough zigs and zags there that I don't think you need to be worried.
That it might make it hard, but isn't that part how activists these judges are?
Right.
Well, one thing that, you know, that I really think is worth remembering is that there's, of course, disproportionate enforcement under the law. And so New York Public Radio, WNYC, a journalist named John Keefe did a data mashup that showed basically how there was disproportionate stop and frisk for marijuana possession in black and brown neighborhoods in New York. And I think that one thing that I'm concerned about, it's not the gender implications, it's the racial implications of this. And you know, because law enforcement is human, and also people live very differently. If you're walking, it's a lot easier to stop you and frisk you than it is if you're in a car. Mm-hmm. So economics also plays into it.
Can I add something here? And I think you're exactly right about the racial implications of this decision being at the foreground. One, One thing that's disturbing off the bat is that this case began in New Jersey, on the New Jersey Turnpike, which many of us remember, right? This is where the term racial profiling originated, with people being stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike. The second is, if you read that decision, the court really decided, and it was really a distinction between the law as it's practiced, or rather law enforcement as it's practiced in theory and as it is in reality. And so the majority that said that you can be strip searched for any offense, even a traffic ticket, said they were doing so because they wanted to make sure that people didn't have lesions that might indicate they had a communicable disease and then come into a crowded jail or prison, right, and transmit them and so on. While that might be a concern, a much, much more realistic concern is that African Americans disproportionately will be arrested, will be humiliated, will be entered into in this instance, it wasn't even an accurate traffic stop. This person was arrested for a ticket, for a fine that he'd paid, and the system didn't include that he'd actually paid.
And he was a passenger in the car.
And he was a passenger in the car.
I saw this really wonderful and yet horrible kind of cartoon about this, demonstrating kind of the willingness there. See, it's both wonderful and horrible, of the conservative members of the court to, despite being supposedly conservative members of the court, to shine the light of government on literally our most intimate space. And so you do have to ask this question, why would it be these folks, right, who are most willing to make this particular choice?
I think the answer is that the war on crime and the war on drugs, which is both of which are a war on Americans more than anything, and, mm-hmm. and specifically lower income and minority Americans, that has made people crazy in the judicial system. I mean, their eyes turn purple. They turn into the Hulk when they talk about criminal justice issues, distinct from other intrusions of government. Scalia had an incredible speech this week defending this thing. He was talking about his own judicial philosophy. He's like, I'm an originalist. You know, he and Clarence Thomas are famously the biggest originalists. I think we ought to go to the original meaning of the Constitution. And oh yeah, this decision was great. Because you know those prisons, they're really tough to manage nowadays, and so we have to keep.
Wow.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. Like, really?
So much. Yeah, really. I'm an originalist because these prisons are.
I mean, but think. Yeah. I mean, we know what the founders thought about search and seizure, right, from the government.
Right. Absolutely.
They didn't like it, absolutely, and this is incredibly increasing the cost of every time that you come in contact, even have a conversation with someone in law enforcement right now. It's a terrible decision. It is distinct for whatever reason in the minds of that majority from other economic issues, commerce clause issues, and other things, and it has something to do with Obamacare too, because Gonzalez versus Raich, which is the biggest commerce clause decision before this, and which Scalia was on, in my view, the wrong side on that. That was a medical marijuana case, mm-hmm. and so because that was seen as part of the war on crime, he flipped, and I think was on the wrong side of that, and that will affect how the Affordable Care Act case.
Can I jump in and pull a Melissa Harris Perry move on here? Because I think that one of the things that you do as a teacher is to bring out the counterintuitive aspects of decisions. So I want to say that I disagree with this decision. I want to be very clear about that, but I also think that there's a silver lining here. Mm-hmm. So the silver lining is that in criminal procedure type issues, particularly with respect to jails, the Supreme Court has been supremely hands off with mm-hmm. respect to, you know, just if that's a separate population, you know, we're going to treat it as a separate population, and we're just not going to explore the constitutional implications. There are two rights that are guaranteed in prisons that I can think of. One is the right to be free from racial segregation, and then the other one is the right to marry. So those are the two rights that I can think of as having transcended the boundaries of the prison. I think one thing that's fascinating about this decision, even though it's no exception to the general rule of deference, is that the things that you can be strip searched for are so broad that everyone is implicated, every American of all races. So I think that Breyer's opinion, his dissent, really underscores this in saying, look at the things that you could be taken in for, arrested for, and then strip searched for. Mm-hmm. There are things like not having a muffler on your car. Right. There are things like making an illegal left turn signal.
Yeah.
It's not having a bell on your bicycle. It's like, you know, not obeying a dog leash law. Yep. These are things that every American can relate to. So the thing that I'm hopeful about is that this will generate enough outrage, because the kind of empathy failure that we have to the prison mm-hmm. population breaks down when you realize this could be me.
Right.
The police could randomly pull me over, take me to jail after having arrested me, and then strip search me in this, you know.
It's interesting because it could, on the one hand, create that sort of empathy. On the other hand, the likelihood of precisely who is
right.
most likely to get pulled over is actually not sort of the suburban, you know, lady
right.
with the dog. Thank you all both, actually all four of you, so much for hanging out and having this conversation with me.